I know firsthand how exhausting it can be to manage all the tasks in my reselling business, like listing, bookkeeping, and more, but I found a solution that has given me back my time and allowed me to grow my business, hiring a virtual assistant. And now I want to share that solution with you. That's why I've created an online course called Hiring a Virtual Assistant for Your Reselling Business. With this course, you'll learn everything you need to know to find, train, and manage a virtual assistant like a pro. And because I want to make this course accessible to everyone, I'm offering a special coupon code, FLIPTHESCRIPT, that gives you $10 off at checkout. Don't miss out on this opportunity to take your reselling business to the next level. Sign up now at hiringava.com and let's enjoy the freedom and fun of growing our businesses together. Again, you can sign up at hiringava.com. Welcome to the Flip the Script podcast. I'm your host, Denali, and I'm a full-time reseller on eBay and Poshmark. My store and closet name is El Ducho, E-L-D-U-C-H-O, and you can find me on Instagram and YouTube as El Ducho Thrift. I'm very excited about this week's episode. I had the opportunity to speak with a new friend, and her name is Issa. You can find Issa on Instagram under the username The Global Collective Co., and all of that information will be in the show notes for you. Issa is a full-time reseller who operates her business out of California. However, that's not where she's living right now. Issa has an interesting business model that allows her to be virtually anywhere and operate her business virtually, which is kind of awesome and I think will intrigue a lot of you. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. Hi, Issa. Thanks for being on the podcast with me.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. I have been waiting for this day for a long time. So this is happening. It's happening in 2020 for me. So,
oh, I didn't tell you this is going to air in 2021. No, I'm just kidding.
You know what? That's fine. I made it in 2020.
Exactly. Something to look forward to then. Yes. Well, I'm so excited to have this conversation. I've been following you for some time now on Instagram. I don't know how long it's been. If you know, everything always feels like forever. If you told me it's been 10 years, I would say, yeah, you're right. It has been 10 years.
Especially here, so it's all understandable.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm so excited to, you know, we talk through direct messages, but I want to get to know you a little bit better and be able to share your story and information with everybody. So this is always my great excuse to have longer conversations with people, to just record it for a podcast.
I can talk nonstop, so feel free to cut me off whenever it's time to, you know.
No, you're good. I always tell people the best guests are people who are talkers. So let's do it. So I guess with that said, let's jump into my first question, which is how and when did you first start reselling, Issa?
So my story is a little bit different than most of the resellers that I've met in this community and stuff like that. I had never thrifted. I had never, you know, been in that industry or heard of it really. I was mostly in fashion and marketing. I did everything from like retail sales to retail management. I did retail buying and brand management. So I was just totally in a different space, but because I worked in fashion for so long, I accumulated so much good stuff. And when I say good stuff, girl, let me tell you, like I worked for All Saints for like a year. Mm-hmm. I did all their studio press pulls. So like any celebrity, any stylist that would come in, I'd have to walk them through kind of like what we suggest that they take, kind of like our picks, our pieces that we wanted showcased. And I got so much free clothes. I mean, I think we used to get like $2,500 a season. Wow. In uniforms. And then if they wanted to showcase a piece and someone was coming in, I would be gifted the piece so that I would be wearing it when they would come in and kind of like sell them on it. Mm-hmm. So I had a closet full of All Saints clothes. I worked for like the big, you know, the big department stores, Nordstrom and Bloomingdale's. And when I worked at Bloomingdale's, we would get like So we would get these crazy discounts, like 30 on 30 on 30 on whatever discount it had if it was black. So, I mean, I already dress like Morticia Adams every day of my life. So for me, it was like the best thing that ever happened. I would get, crazy discounts on designers, items, shoes, anything that was black. So, I just ended up with all this great stuff that I never paid full price for. And it's funny because I think the first piece I ever did was an All Saints sequin dress. And I mean, I wore that thing for like 6 months, every other day. I loved the dress. But it looked pretty new because I was just in the store. And when I didn't want to wear it in my real life because it felt like my uniform. I remember putting it on eBay thinking, oh, whatever I get for it is fine. And it sold for almost retail value.
Oh,
So I
wow.
was like, wait a second, what am I holding on to here? And so I just started selling all of my items. That was just my personal stuff, though. But I realized the potential of, what the money that was sitting in my closet. And then I think I kind of stumbled on reselling by accident. I was at a buy sell trade store in Los Angeles, and I saw a leather bag just from far away. But I did the whole fashion school thing. We had like three or four classes on like textiles and textures and the difference between silk and satin and le this leather and that leather. So I'm really good with fabrics. And I saw that purse in the back, like kind of they had it in the back because it was kind of more expensive. It was like $40. And I was like, that thing is not cheap. Like, I just know it's not. Like, there were so many panels of like Napa leather and the way it was made. I was like, this has got to be, something more. So I picked it up. I saw Burberry, but I knew it was the higher end Burberry and they had priced it like the normal Burberry. So I bought it right away. I took it home. I listed it. And I don't remember how long it took to sell, but it didn't take more than 2 weeks. And it sold for $480 or something like that. And I was hooked. Like, I was hooked. So I just made it that, it just became my, side hustle, my hobby. And it just kept growing and growing and growing. And so I kept putting more and more time into it. And, I was working full time. I was working at a beer company in sales and marketing. And I would do this on the weekends and I just became obsessed. It was like Vegas. You pick something up and you don't know how much you're going to get for it. You have an idea, but it when the app bings and you're like, oh man, there's money in there. It's just so exciting. And so I did that to a point where I was a brand manager for Pabst Blue Ribbon, which you might be familiar with because you're in the Pacific Northwest. And I used to have like the corner cubicle with the brand team. And my direct boss was the CMO, this amazing guy. I love him. And he would literally walk by and see me shipping under my desk. And he'd be like, hey, when you're done shipping your Tory Burches, is there any way that I could get time with you? And we would just crack up. He was so supportive of it. So I started reselling kind of by accident, kind of with my own stuff. And then it kind of grew and grew and grew. I've done it for 7 years, but I didn't start the Global Collective in this presentation in this kind of like higher end setting until 2 years ago. So that's kind of the not so short version of what happened.
No, that was a nutshell. I think that was a very compact version of the story. So, you alluded to that you went to fashion school, because when you first started talking, you're mentioning working with stylists and working at All Saints, and my initial thought or question was, okay, does she have a fashion background? I'm curious, you went to fashion school. What was your intention? Like, when you went there, what did you think your job was going to be when you graduated from fashion school?
So I didn't graduate. I went to fashion school for fashion design. And I mean, this is kind of like a long story, but I won't get into it. But it was kind of a weird time in my life with like family stuff and a lot going on. And I couldn't handle the pressure of going to school and working full time. I was working at Nordstrom's at that time. So I was doing full time hours at Nordstrom. And then I was doing a side business of I would help my clients clean out their closets and charge it for them, charge them for it. And then I would help them buy whatever they needed, the styles that I picked out for them for me at Nordstrom. So then I would get commission off of it. So it was like this great scheme I had going on. And fashion school kind of, it was really expensive. I think it was FIDM, and it was like 2200 for the year. 20, sorry, not 2200, 22,000 for the year. And it got to a point where when I started fashion school, I thought I would be a fashion designer. That's what I thought I wanted to do. And as I went through the program, I kind of had this epiphany where I'm like, wait a minute. I don't want to be the one sewing the clothes. I don't want to be the one in the workshop. Like, I want to kind of design it and pass it on to my team that I'm going to hire when I'm really rich, So it kind of started losing its allure. I think it was kind of like a childhood dream. And the more I went into it, the more I was like, this is absolutely not what I want to do. And then what I was doing on my full-time job was kind of more appealing. And I was learning a lot about sales and, how brands work. And I was making a ton of money at Nordstrom because there was no crisis then and people were buying like crazy. And so I had to I had to make the executive decision to leave fashion school. And I think I made the right choice. I just don't, I wasn't going to be a fashion designer. I don't think that was ever my calling. But I will say that what I did learn in fashion school, that has given me a leg up in reselling, especially designer stuff, are those textile classes. Like, my brother makes fun of me, but I can just look at something far away and tell you if it's like Napa leather, if it's fake leather, if it's silk, if it's satin, if it's chiffon, if it's polyester. There's, just by touching something, I know what I'm dealing with. So for me, I think that's kind of like that definitely is something that I will take with me forever. I would never go back to fashion design because it's just not, if I could tell myself something, and some advice now is, hey, what if you try business school? Or what if you just get a business degree and like at a community college and then go to like a UC or, one of the state schools or whatever. But the point is, I do think that while I did get some stuff from going to fashion school that have helped me, I think working in the fashion industry has completely changed the game for me. Like, I think that I don't think I realized how much I had learned from each of my jobs until I built the Global Collective. And I feel like every job that I had, whether it was sales at a high-end department store or, retail buying for Kitson or, that All Saints job. So I think every single thing I had to do, kind of prepared me for what I would need to run the Global Collective the way I do. If
Oh,
that
for
makes any
sure.
sense.
No, totally. Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, I think all the decisions that we make in our lives, or my school of thought sounds similar to you, is that, yeah, a lot of the decisions we make in our lives might sound questionable in the moment, but they all lead up to what's coming for us.
100%. 100%. And I think that's part of the like, it's that the having faith that everything will work out thing. Like, you work hard, you take as much as you can from wherever you are in life, but you keep the faith alive that this will all come together at some point. And then one day it just does. And I'm like, oh, wow, I get why I had to do all those floor setups at Juicy Couture. Like, I get why I had to fold items every 5 minutes. I get why I straighten racks every 2 minutes at these stores. Like, I get why I had to handwrite notes at Nordstrom's. And it blows my mind that they gave me so much, but I didn't know until recent.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so thinking about when you first sold that All Saints dress on eBay, was that the first time you had ever sold online?
Yes.
Okay, so what time period are we talking about? Like, is how far back was that from at
Like
this
7 years
point?
ago.
Okay, so 7 years ago, you list that on eBay. it sells for almost retail value. Were you, I think you kind of said, but you were hooked at that moment? Like, how often at that point were you then listing? Like, was it the next day you listed like a million items, or was it kind of like a slow build over time?
No, I got hooked. Like, I became obsessed with reselling. So once that sold, I was like, well, let me get rid of all Saints pieces now. I'm glad I did, because let's just say that I have gained some, you know, LBs in the time. I think it comes with wisdom, but none of that stuff would fit. So I sold it at the perfect time. Things were flying out of my eBay, you know, site, my store or whatever. Mm-hmm. I had so many leather pieces. I had like leather dress. I had the most amazing pieces. So I did so well with it. And then I think what, like I said, what really triggered, what really started the reselling for money, just as investment, was that leather Burberry bag that was so mm-hmm. completely undervalued. And I was like, just looking at it, I knew that it was worth more than what, you know, what they had it for. And so from there, I started going to all the buy, sell, trade stores and just, you know, reading everything I could. I had the advantage, though, that I'd worked at all these department stores. So even the obscure brands that people didn't really know that well, I knew mm-hmm. what they were. So I was able to pick up a lot of stuff and make really decent money. I would spend all of my weekends doing that. I was like, hey, boyfriend, hope you have a great Saturday, because I'm on my way to hit up like five different buy, sell, trade stores all day. I was hooked. I did it as much as I could. I made really good money. I just couldn't believe it. The way I explained it to my brother was like, to me, this whole world had opened up where, you know, there was all this money sitting in these stores and it was just waiting for me to find it. And it just became this, like the thrill, the hunt, the chase, I know, you know what I mean? Like the yes. second your eBay bings and you know, there's money in there, you're like, how much did I pull off on this?
Okay. So, you know, at what point in the past 7 years did you switch over and go into full-time reselling? Because like you said, I think your last job before going into reselling was working for a beer company. Is that right? So,
yeah, so
what mm-hmm. period of time was that and what triggered that?
So I left that job 3 years ago. So 3 years ago, I quit past. And I think I tell a lot of people this, I have it in my newsletters. Like, this is always something that I talk about openly. Mm-hmm. I didn't just jump ship and wonder what the world was going to throw at me. I made an escape plan. I said, you know, my boyfriend and I had plans to like travel and like do some stuff. And it just had to be done in certain time frame. So I made a plan and I was like, I'm going to save, you know, this much money. And the day that I have this much money, I can quit and go mm-hmm. into reselling full time. So I did it and it was glorious. And I did it for like a year and a half before this was all the Global Collective, and it worked great. The problem is, and I have an article about this in my newsletter, I was used to making corporate money. Mm-hmm. So I was used to spending corporate money. So girlfriend over here kept, you know, her really expensive highlights and her nails and her, you know, getting coffee every day. And now I was free every day. So it was, you know, lunch with a friend here, lunch with a friend there. And I literally, you know, one day I checked my account and $15,000 were missing. And I was like, oh my God, somebody stole my bank account. That's my first reaction, right? They hacked into it and stolen all my money. Mm-hmm. No, I spent it. There's a crazy math equation somewhere on my blogs, but I think it's like it takes spending $30 a day to spend $11,000 a year, which blows my mind. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, 30 here, 30 there doesn't sound like a lot until it's compounded over a year.
Right.
And you're like, what the heck did I do? So that happened. I you know, I had invested some of that money into reselling. So I made it all back. I was able to save myself from this huge mistake I'd made, but it was tough. And it was tough. And I was working out, I was working myself out of the hole. And it felt like, when I worked at Nordstrom's, you would have this killer week where you sold, thousands of dollars and you were going to make all this money. But the next week you start, 5,000 in the hole. So before
Right.
you make any money, you've got to work yourself out of that. And so that's kind of what I did. I literally just worked to build my money that I had spent myself back up. And then I took some time off. I sold off all of my inventory. I just stopped doing it. My boyfriend and I started traveling in Europe and, like we did Asia, we did China, we did Cambodia, Vietnam. And I'm so happy we did that when we did because, with everything happening, I don't know if travel will ever be the same again. I don't know when it will go back. So I feel like, again, all of these things have kind of worked themselves out in the perfect time. And then we were in Europe for a little bit, and I didn't know what to do with my life. I missed reselling so much. I don't think I'd realized until that point how important it had become for me and how much I enjoyed it and how, it wasn't a job. It was what I loved to do. So I just, I was very sad for a few months trying to figure all this out. And then one night I was like, I'm going to resell again, but I'm going to build this up so that I never have to be in one place, And it sounds crazy, right? Like, what the heck is she talking about? Like, she doesn't have to be in one place. And it's like, I just realized that my new goal was to build my reselling business back up, but build it in a way that, it would work without me. So that's kind of, the Global Collective was born 2 years ago in a cafe in Budapest. That's where I actually built I built my website in a McDonald's in Budapest, and then I launched it in a little cafe, and I was like, this is gonna work. This is and it has. It's been working for 2 years, so knock on wood.
So explain to me, what is the Global Collective and how do you grow a business that you don't have to entirely be present for?
So the Global
Physically
Collective,
present.
I'm present. I'm just Wi-Fiing my life there. The Global Collective is a carefully curated collection of pre-owned, new and pre-loved designer goods. That's kind of the phrase that that's what I built around. That's the thing I wrote down on paper, and I was like, this is what it's going to be. So I did have money to invest, but again, this money wasn't gifted to me. My boyfriend didn't give it to me. I didn't win it in the lottery. Like, I worked and saved for this money for when I had an idea and something I wanted to start, So I start buying online like a crazy person. I just start sourcing and sourcing and sourcing and sourcing. Everything's going to my cousin's house in LA. She's like, have you lost your mind? And I'm like, don't worry, just put them in the closet. So I start sourcing and sourcing. At the same time, I have a lot of friends that have designer goods and, clients I've met from the past and mom's friends and whatever. So I start reaching out to them and I'm like, hey guys, remember when I used to resell? Well, I'm coming back, but it's going to be a consignment store. It's going to be a designer store. Like, it's a totally different concept. I kind of sent them my makeshift logo and like my brand story or whatever I came up with. And a lot of them were on board right away. They're like, sure, what do we do with this stuff? The first thing I did for the Global Collective to work was to talk to one of my best friends. She was my roommate. She's been my friend since I can remember. And I talked to her, and she's a stay-at-home mom. She has two little girls. They were little there. They were like 1 and 3 or something. And she had been wanting to get back to work, but story of a lot of us, it's hard. Like, I don't have kids, but I know a lot of my friends, childcare is so expensive. You're basically working to have someone watch your kids. And so, it was just hard for her to like justify going back to work and figuring the logistics out. And I was like, I've got an opportunity for you. I'm going to send you a bunch of stuff. and you're going to photograph it and I'm going to list it. And then we're going to be this like dynamic duo and it's going to work. And bless her heart, she didn't ask anything. She's like, I'm in. So she, right now I have two girls. They're both my friends, Fernanda and Jennifer. Thank you, because none of this works without you. But they're the motor behind the Global Collective. So the way I set it up is I am the face of the brand. I do the branding, marketing, the editing, all of that stuff, but the girls process for me. So it doesn't matter where I am, as long as I have Wi-Fi, and I know they're always there because they both work from home. So it just was this amazing setup that came together. And
so are they fulfilling shipping for you?
They're photographing and fulfilling shipping. So they work on commission. And then that's the thing, when a lot of people ask if I thrift and stuff, I have no problem with thrifting. I've actually thrifted for a reseller friend when I've been in LA to kind of like help her out, see if there's anything good there. Mm-hmm. I just have to hit certain margins and certain numbers to be able to pay these girls commission and their fee and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why I'm not snobby. I don't just choose to be designer for no reason. It's the numbers that I need to hit. And that's just the easiest way to do it for me.
So, okay. So thinking about sourcing, and you say that for the most part, you are not thrifting, you're doing all your sourcing online. I imagine most places, excuse me, that you are sourcing from are probably fairly obvious. Do you mind sharing, like, what does your sourcing online process look like? What are your qualifiers for buying items?
Yeah. And I want to say this, I know this has been a little controversial in our industry or in our community. Mm-hmm. But I want to say it because we've talked about this before. I feel a responsibility to the people that follow me to be completely transparent, to be honest, to give you my point of views, my advice, what works for me. And it is slightly frustrating sometimes when I hear people say, well, I don't have that stuff around me. Well, I don't live around that stuff. Well, I can't buy the better stuff because I live in a, small town, or like people in LA are so lucky because, they have all the stuff. Kind of, but I have not been in a store since February 12th this year. Mm-hmm. And 90% of the items I own come from online. And I'm literally never in one place. So, when you are in that situation where your town probably doesn't have the best stuff, or you're in a smaller area, or you don't get these crazy brands that people in LA are finding, then find them online. When you source online, the world is your oyster. I source online all day, every day from my bed in pajamas. So, it's something that I've just kind of been able to learn quick and know what I'm looking for. I talk about this a lot too. When I source online, I'm looking for undervalued assets. I'm looking for anything that I think that I can sell for the amount that I need to hit to pay these girls to keep this operation going. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times, I talk about this all the time, like pictures are everything. Presentation is everything. So a common theme in my newsletters and stuff is how I constantly sell items over market value. And I am 100% convinced that a big role in that are my pictures. So when I'm sourcing, I look for people that don't take that much time with their pictures. Because that asset seems priced lower. It doesn't get as much attention. You know what I mean? Like those are kind of the buying opportunities that I'm looking for.
So, I guess to dig a little deeper there, can you tell me, like, what's the last item, if you don't mind sharing all of this, I'm just assuming that you're willing to share. What's the last item you sourced online, if you don't mind sharing? Where did you get it from? And just like, what was your thought process with that item?
I will share one that's actually on my stories right now.
Okay.
I had been following this specific shoe since like for a few months, for I mean, not even a few, I think 6 months now. It's been a while that I just saw this shoe and I'm like, she's not gonna be able to sell it like that. You know, that it's so crazy, but I can just look at a listing now and think, yeah, that's gonna be there for a while. So I knew that was gonna stay. So I followed and followed and followed and followed and followed. And then I saw she relisted it for 100. And I'll tell you what it is and how much it's worth. But I was like, so here's the thing, right? I talk about negotiation a lot too. I would have happily paid the 150. These are really expensive designer boots. But I'm a business person. I'm trying to get the best deal I can because the best deal I can means more profit for me. And I'm not stealing it from her. I'm in this art of negotiation thing where if she's willing to take my bid, then all I did was ask. So I waited on, and we started the negotiation, and the negotiation is on my stories right now, but I guess it won't be on there when this airs, but I can put it on highlights or something. So it started at 100 and I offered 70, and then she went to 90, and then I went to like, I don't know what the next one was, and then she went to 85. No, she went, okay, so whatever. So we ended up at 85. And she was at 90 and I offered 85. There's no difference to me in those $5, but there is something about the art of negotiation where you're like, but can I get away with it? You know? And I did. She accepted it. And in her mind, she's probably thinking, God, I've had these for months. They're sitting there. No one's bought them. Like, let's just move them, you know? I don't think she's a reseller, also. I think we assume that everyone on there is a reseller. And there's a lot of people that just want to get rid of their stuff. So that's something to consider that, some people just don't want to deal with this stuff anymore. She probably doesn't care how much they were. She had a lot of designer items in her closet. So I'm sure she was just trying to clear space.
And was this, are we talking about Poshmark?
Poshmark, yes.
Gotcha.
And
So what was the item and what is the actual value of the item?
they were Saint Laurent boots that are still currently on the retailer sites, and they were $1,095.
Wow. So, okay. Are you tired of spending hours sharing and sending offers to likers? Introducing Posher VA, the web program that will save you time and increase your sales. With Posher VA, you can automatically share your closet, send offers to likers, and schedule your share times all with just a few clicks. Using code ELDUCHO, you can try Posher VA for 2 weeks for free, no credit card required. Posher VA is not just another program, it is your program. Say goodbye to manual sharing and hello to even more time in your business. Try Posher VA today using code ELDUCHO, ELDUCHO. That's MSRP was $1,095.
Yeah.
So what do you like in terms of resale, right? Because we know you got them now for about 85 roughly, you know, shipping and tax also going to be included into that. But like, what are you anticipating like listing and selling them at?
Like $4.99.
Nice. That's a good
Yeah.
price.
So I actually did it with another pair of boots that I put on my stories too. Somebody had this crazy bad picture where, you know, where you do with the app that takes out the background, but it doesn't do it all the way. So these looked really bad because it left kind of like an edge of the carpet she took the picture on. So they, didn't really stand out. I bought them for $155. They were $1,000 Saint Laurent boots. And this was another pair. And I told them, I took an offer for $360 a week later, just because the girl messaged me on Vestiaire and she's like, hey, I'm going to pay €100 in shipping and processing and, importation tax or whatever. Would you take this offer? I'm like, sure. You know, it's a pretty decent flip for me already. So why not?
Yeah. Okay, so Poshmark is somewhere that you're using. I mean, I have to imagine you probably source, you know, similarly like on eBay, because
I
we have
source on
people.
platforms. And here's the kicker. This is one of those things I was telling you is controversial. I talk a lot about how comps do not equal market value. The value of an item is determined by its condition and brand and market value. It's not determined by comps. And so what I try to tell all the people that, you know, read my newsletter and stuff is, think of this story that I just told you, right? I'm the girl messing up comps for you. So if you found YSL boots, I mean, Saint Laurent boots, randomly at your buy sell trade store or whatever, and you looked up comps, you would find my buying comp. You would find the 85. So if you're pricing based on comps, you're pricing based off whatever the situation was where I bought these shoes for so little, you know?
Right.
So I think that that's kind of like a big deal for me, is I find these crazy undervalued assets and then I flip them to what they're supposed to be worth. And I think that the customers appreciate that, because as resellers, we're trying to make as much profit as we can, right? In the least amount of time or whatever. But as a customer, if you were looking for these Saint Laurent boots that are in excellent condition, that were originally, you know, $1,000, 360 is a steal. So I'm like, I think that you kind of have to look at this sourcing online as, forget comps, because I don't use comps on the buying, on the selling side. I use comps on the buying side. I go look at comps and see what is the lowest I could possibly get on this kind of shoe that I'm looking for. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Well, and then in the same breath, I'm like, well, assuming you list that item again on, let's say, Poshmark, right? We get both ends of the comps, right? We get your buy comp and we get your sell comp.
Exactly. But the problem is, see, if I bought it this week, and then you found your boots this week, and you only price based off comps and there's no other comp, you're going to be like, oh shoot, I guess these are only worth 85. I'm going to go crazy and price them at 100. But if you had found them the next week, you'd find my sold comp and you'd be like, oh, 360, I'm going to go 400. So it's weird, because people price religiously based on comps, and it doesn't make sense. We don't know what happened in that sale. We don't know the circumstances of it.
Right.
We don't know who was selling it. Like in one of my newsletter articles, I gave them an example of, you know, if Mrs. Jones used her Manolo Blahniks one time for her daughter's wedding, and she just wants to clear her closet, she has no need for money, she just wants them out, and she sells them for $150, does Mrs. Jones determine the value of Manolo Blahnik from now on? No.
Right.
No. It was a different circumstance. So that's kind of what, that's my spiel on comps anyway.
No, I like it. Different perspective. Okay. So shifting back to kind of my regularly scheduled questions, I guess, you know, we talked about, you started originally selling on eBay. You've said that you shop on Poshmark. You know, where do you sell now currently? Where is your business selling online?
Let me just clarify this. I shop everywhere I sell. So I shop all the platforms. This is why you guys have to remember that I am the person messing up your comps. right now, I sell on eBay, Tradesy, Poshmark, Vestiaire Collective, and my own website.
And what is, you know, is there one platform that's like your main platform where you do the most amount of your sales?
It used to be eBay for a long time. eBay's changed a lot since they started doing the promoting listings and stuff. It hasn't been as magical. I don't know what is going on, but eBay used to be the biggest. I used to make the most though per item on Tradesy. Tradesy has this like magical power that people don't even ask questions. They just buy.
Right.
Very little work involved. And they have the highest commission, but I'm able to sell items much more expensive there. And then lately I've been doing really well on Vestiaire, which is a European brand, a European platform. But I think the clients on there, first of all, they're global. And I think they are looking for a little bit of a higher end product. So it gives me that image that people already know they're going to have to spend a little more, you know?
Yeah. And being that you sell, you know, primarily designer items, have you used platforms like The RealReal to sell on? I'm sure you buy from there, but have you ever sold on there? Do you prefer or not prefer to sell somewhere like that?
I have not, because they take such a big cut on commission, or they used, I think they used to take 50%. And call me crazy, because I am, but I like the control. Like I like that I can choose what my cover photo is on all these other platforms that I sell on. I like that it's not all their call. I like my people to take my pictures the way that I like them to be taken. So for me, it's a little bit about, like, you know, I'm trying to build a brand. Like, I really want the Global Collective to stand on its own and to have people recognize it and stuff. So I think a big part of that is my aesthetic and the presentation of it. So I fear kind of letting other people take the control. I've seen people post pictures of, like, they sent a dress to ThredUp, and instead of putting the waist tie in the waist, they put it around the neck or something. And it's like, I don't know if I need that. You know?
I'm thinking of an item I sent to ThredUp. Excuse me. It was a child's dress, but they thought it was like a women's tank top.
That's where it's like,
it's a pretty funny photo.
You have no control over it. And it's like, if it was stuff that I, you know, I got it for $10 or whatever, like, whatever, if they take a bad picture, sure. But I do invest a lot in my goods. So I want them to move, and I want them to look the way I want them to look. And I want people to literally just look at a picture and be like, oh, that's a Global Collective product, you know?
Yeah. So being that you are kind of don't have a home base, right? Mm-hmm. You're traveling, and you've got employees who are doing work for you back in Los Angeles, I think is what you said.
Yeah, San Diego.
Okay, got it. San Diego, Southern California in general. you know, what does the workspace look like? Because if you have employees who are getting sent, like, you're sending the inventory to them, they're processing it and they're shipping it out. So is your inventory, you mentioned two employees, is it divided up at each of their homes, or do they have a central base?
They have the stuff in their homes. It started with Fernanda, who was the first one. We were going to rent a space, and then she's like, I'm telling you, the her baby was like maybe one, maybe not one. She might have been little. And she was like, hey, is there any way that I could keep the product here? Because I don't know, you know, if I can get away with the two girls and this the car seats and this to every time something sells. And she has like a little, she has the perfect little back room with nothing in it. So we set up all the shelving areas there for her. And I was like, sure. And she has like the door locks on this little back unit. So it's perfect. It's literally the Global Collective storage, and I pay her a storage fee. So it was just easier that way. And then when the second girl came along, I asked her, hey, Fernanda does it this way. Do you want me to get you storage, or do you want to have it at your home? And she's like, well, I'd rather have it at my home. And same thing, she works from home, and she has a whole room that she uses as her office. So that's kind of her, like, her freelance office and the Global Collective.
So between the two employees, how much, if you know off the top of your head, how many, like, total pieces of inventory do you have right now? Like, I guess listed or active?
About like 300. But then we have, like, right now is a weird time because I sent a huge box full of designer stuff right up. I won't be doing that again, but I won't get into that right now. So I've been missing for a month and a half. And they were like 40 pieces or whatever. And then normally I keep an inventory about like of 300 pieces listed. And then there's always, I mean, items come in every single day. And then Fernanda deals with the consignments. So the consignments are separate. We have like a whole nother setup and situation for the people that consign. And those have to be cared for differently, and those are stocked differently, and those we take inventory monthly on that, because, you know, we're getting Louis Vuittons and really expensive stuff, so we got to make sure that everything's up to par, up to speed or whatever. So I would say, like, I always have around 300 listed, If items come in every day, but some items go, some items are sent to the cobbler, some items are sent to get fixed, some items are sent to get dry clean. And so while we wait, product keeps coming in. Yeah, I went crazy during the COVID times because sales were so bad. There was nothing for me to do. It was an incredible buyer's market and I had cash. So I was like, well, here we go. And I got some great deals and I'm happy I did that. But that's kind of, it's counterintuitive when the whole economy feels like it's just going under and you've got cash and you're like, keep this, do I hoard this or do I, put it to work? And I decided to put it to work and it's worked out so far. I'm gonna knock wood again, but
I mean, listen, I'm the same way as you. I would put it to work also, but I know not everybody, some people are risk adverse, so it's a gamble. But similarly, on that note, now, I don't necessarily have this fear, but to somebody listening who says, wow, she's got these two employees, the inventory is coming into their homes, they're photographing, processing, listing it, fulfilling the shipping, doing all these parts of, the daily parts of this business, isn't she nervous that they're just going to start reselling on their own?
No, I think that's the key of like good leadership and the success of big companies is who you pick to be on your team. I picked two friends that, that are, one of them is literally my lifelong friend, and the other girl I've known for years now. We've become great friends, and neither of them have any interest in the fashion industry. They don't really. They have no interest in this world, but it's a really good fee that they make and the commission, and they have no working hours. I literally send them lists and say, I need this done by the end of the week. I don't care if they do it all in one day. I don't care if they do chunks every day. I don't care how it gets done, as long as it's done by the end of the week. And so for them, I think it's great because they have their own things going on. Fernanda's pregnant again, so she's about to become a mom for the third time. So she's got a lot on her plate. And Jennifer has her own HR consulting company. But again, I think as girls, we have this fascination with pretty stuff, right? I mean, they're so pumped when stuff comes in. They'll both send me pictures of them trying on shoes and stuff. So I think it's like a cool side hustle for them that they have no interest in. And the second part of that is what I have shown them, they could resell on their own. Like they have all of my formulas of like how to photograph. They have all the tools. They have light boxes. They have lights. They have everything they could possibly need. They have literal manuals on how I like pictures taken at what angles. And Jennifer can confirm if you've talked to her, I'm really crazy on images. And so she'll send me something and I'll be like, hey, do you mind taking this at like a 45 degree angle instead of like a 60? And she's like, what are you talking about? But then I'll show her and she's like, oh, that does make sense. So I've trained them to be able to kind of make my vision come alive, but they have no interest in it on their own. And they're such good people and good friends. And I think they enjoy their job, but I think at the same time, they want to help me make this work, So I think it's people you choose to help you or to support you in your business.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, well, I guess my next question for you is, what are the challenges you feel like you face in your business right now? And I mean, obviously 2020 has been a challenging year. So, maybe it relates to, the pandemic and I don't know, shifts in luxury buying. Or, maybe the reasons are more personal. What do you feel like are your current challenges?
So, to be very honest, the Global Collective ran completely smoothly since the day I started it. And then COVID hit, and then this pandemic hit, and I got hit hard. And when I say hard, we were doing like a fourth or a fifth of what sales used to be during like months of, May, June, July. Even August was kind of bad. So I had, you know, I had never had to navigate that situation. I had always had a stable job before. And when I quit reselling, aside from me making that stupid mistake of blowing money on nothing, I had always kind of, everything had always worked. You know, the economy was good. People were shopping. I was able to sell used designer shoes for $400. It was like a no-brainer. And then when this comes along, it forces me to kind of realize that I've just been lucky for a long time, and I have to put some serious, you know, thought into what happens when, you know, economies go down, what happens when recessions hit. And I think the biggest problem for me was I had been able to get these great deals and flip them for a high dollar amount. And then Nordstrom Rack starts fire selling Manolos and Gucci, and, you know, Century 21 starts giving away Valentinos. And we're talking about $1,000 shoes being sold for $200, like new Louboutin, like So Kates for $200. In what world? So how, you know, how do we compete with brand new Louboutins that, you know, the resellers were getting them for $200 and selling at $399? What do I do with my used items, you know?
Right.
So market value dropped on them. It got really slow. And the other thing is we were all locked up. No one's going anywhere. So why are you spending on Gucci shoes? People like ramped up on their athleisure wear, you know? So that was an incredible challenge. And then personally, I was set to fly back to Germany on March 6th or something. And I switched my flight because of some issue with the bank for the LLC. Well, that's the week that the world went into full shutdown. They canceled my flight. The U.S. closed borders with Europe. So my partner, my life partner, was here. And then I thought, okay, like quick thinking, I'm going to fly to Mexico City, which is where my mom lives. And I'm going to fly to Europe from there because they haven't closed their borders yet. Well, I go to Mexico City and I hadn't seen my mom in months. So I'm like, I should at least stay here 2 days or something. Well, in those 2 days, Europe closed its borders. So I was, not only was my business tanking, I wasn't able to go back to my partner I didn't see him for 6 months. So it was horrible. I mean, it was the hardest time that I have had with the store and personally. And so, you know, I kept looking at my numbers. They kept going down. I kept paying my girls because I was like, I still have cash reserves. These are my friends. You know, they're having a tough time too. So we're all going down together. So I just, you know, it was a very challenging time. It was a very challenging time. There were days that I was like, this might be it. Like, this is where this goes, and this is how long it worked, and like, goodbye. And then other days I'd be like, no, I'm going to make this work. We're going to like grow and come back. And, you know, like the entrepreneurial struggle, the roller coaster.
Yes.
So I, you know, that this year was incredibly challenging, and I hate to admit this. I really do. But on the flip side, I have never learned more about business, about myself, about what I'm capable of until 2020. And I don't want it to like feel special or anything, but it was. It's also been an amazing year to kind of deal with those challenges. And like, I started my authentication services. I started coaching services. I grew my Instagram from like, I think I was at like 1700 in April to like almost 6,000 now. I had nothing else to do. So I was like, I'm going to focus on the marketing side of this. And it was really tough. I mean, there were days where I didn't know, you know, it was a tough time in our world, in my life. Business was bad. I had these two people that I had to pay. And so I think that's the biggest challenge of having employees, right? It's no longer just you. It's these other people that depend on this business. And so even though there's this part-time, it's important to them. And in my head, I was like, I can't let them down. This has to work. So, yeah.
So kind of, you know, on that note, you you just again alluded to what you've done in the downtime, you know, and I say downtime as like slow down in the business, but kind of bleeds into my next question, which is, you know, where do you see the future of your business growing? I mean, you mentioned that you've been able to grow your social media. You talked earlier about being able to do some sourcing to take advantage of great prices that maybe tanked during the pandemic, or people are just liquidating items from their home. You know, so where do you see kind of the rest of, I don't know, Q4 and maybe even thinking about 2021, if you can think that far?
Yeah, no, I can. That's what's keeping me going. September, I finally saw normal numbers again. I wouldn't say it was the best numbers or anything, but it was that feeling of, oh, we're back. You know, this is going to work. And I think Q4, I'm just trying to like, I'm just trying to get normal numbers back. We're just trying to, I did buy a ton of amazing stuff. So I know that it's going to be good in 2021. I source off season too. So like, you know, come July, I've got like 50 pairs of boots and stuff just waiting for winter. Which is kind of what the department stores do, you know, like the buys are like a year before. And that's when you get the best pricing. So no one's thinking of boots in July, you know. But for the Global Collective, so here's a little tidbit information. Like I haven't talked your ear off for an hour. I wanted to be a teacher since I was really little until I was 18 and I realized that they don't get paid much. And then I was like, that's unfair. That's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to go a totally different route. And I did. And I had a great, you know, career and I did really cool, amazing jobs and I had great opportunities. But I think there was always that little like itch that I wanted to teach. I wanted to share what I've learned. And I think with the Instagram and the way I've taken it, always flip designer goods because of the profits and because it's what I do and it's what I know how to do. And it keeps this lifestyle of me being wherever I want to be and, you know, editing and posting. But I really want to get into this like teaching. And I think the Global Collective kind of becomes this community that incorporates the designer flips and stuff, but more of like a business mentorship, kind of like a, you know, coaching. Or I know everyone's doing courses right now, and I think there's nothing more important than your education. So I fully support anyone that launches a course. Because I think, you know, before the pandemic hit, we're all like, oh, let's go have lunch and pay $50 on, you know, dinner with girls and drinks or whatever. It's like, now I'm like, I'd rather take those $50 and put them in my brain and like learn stuff people that have accomplished what I want to. I think that's kind of the key though, right? Be careful like who you're learning from and like, have they proven what they're teaching you? Like, do they have the background? Do they have the credentials? Do they have, you know, the experience to teach you what they're talking about? And I think that, you know, when we started this interview, I was talking about how kind of like, I felt like I took a piece of the puzzle from every job I had, and then I put it together and built this thing that works. And I think it can be replicated, but I think it wasn't easy. I didn't just go collect the piece. You know, there was a lot of mistakes, a lot of failure, a lot of like just weird mundane jobs. Like what I said is straightening racks and folding velour and stuff. So it's cool to kind of be able to weed out the important stuff and give it to people and say, hey, this is what helped me do what I do. Like, these are the things that make my business successful. Try them, test them. Don't assume I'm giving you absolute truth. Like, go test them out. And if they work, replicate them and keep doing it until, you know, till you can't anymore.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. And I'm with you on education. I mean, I've said before in the podcast, I have a human resources background, so I'm all about continued education. And there's so much to learn. I don't think I'll ever learn enough as a reseller because every day there's really something new that pops up. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know that.
I think with that too, there's an Oscar Wilde quote that is one of my favorite quotes ever. You can never be overdressed or overeducated. And it's kind of like, yeah, You're right. We'll never stop learning. You can always learn. You can always be better. Like, I get questions all the time about my pictures. I take so much pride, like I told you, in my aesthetics, my presentation, my pictures. I taught myself to Photoshop and use Illustrator. I spent 3 months making it my full-time, job and attention when I wasn't figuring out like sourcing and building the Global Collective. I was teaching myself to Photoshop and Illustrate. And it's this amazing thing when you learn something that you didn't imagine you could do. I mean, for me, Photoshop was this crazy tool that designers use, and that's it, right? I have no business playing with this thing. And then when I started doing it, when I saw the results, when I saw what it would bring to my business, I'm like, gosh, I should have done this years ago. And there's a list of like 50 things that I want to learn to do. And I think it's just such a cool thing. It's such a privilege to be able to take your money and invest it back in yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, exactly. That it is a privilege to be able to invest back in yourself because I think even if we think about at traditional jobs, that's not even something you always get with an employer,
No, yeah.
is the ability to reinvest in
And then
yourself.
it's the best investment because you control your future. Like you build up this unique set of skills, and then an opportunity comes along, and you're like, huh, actually, I know how to do that. I taught myself. Or like, I know what you're talking about. I have a ton of course on it. And it's just this, I mean, I'm huge on education, and I know you are too. And I assume because of your HR background, it's just like this. It's so important. And I think that that's kind of where the future of the Global Collective will be. It's some sort of like business education.
That's cool. That's exciting. That's a lot to look forward to in 2021 or Q4, depending on how ambitious you are.
It's good.
But I guess my last question for you, Isa, is, what advice would you give yourself when you were first starting out in reselling?
So the advice I would give myself, like I guess my younger self, is like start now, start 2 years ago. And I think one of the biggest things I could tell myself, my younger self now, is you know so much more than you think. You know so much more than you give yourself credit for. I think I was never shy. I was always a risk taker, but I think I always had this lingering thought of like, it's this weird societal pressure that like I didn't finish college. And so I felt like I wasn't, nobody had certified me to be an expert on anything. And then I think growing up and like doing, making your own business, having your own business and kind of investing and becoming your own person, you're like, I didn't need anyone to tell me that I was good enough or that other that I knew how to do this. I built it myself. And so I think I would tell myself, you know so much more than you think. You're so much more capable than you think. But for resellers, some of the advice, if you take anything from this call, from this podcast, I want you guys to kind of really think about your business as a business. I think, a lot of people that I talk to describe it as like, for fun, my hobby, my pastime. Well, it's kind of my business or on the side or whatever. It's like we have to stop thinking ourselves as kind of these like leisurely resellers. We're business women, we're investing capital in undervalued assets. Like you're not like I went to this Tony Robbins Date with Destiny thing like 2 years ago. And I would need a whole nother hour to tell you everything I learned. But one of the craziest things that happened to me is my partner was this crazy, like, millionaire Swedish guy that sold his tech company and whatever. And I was telling him about my business. I had started the Global Collective by then. And I kept calling it it's kind of like my stock portfolio. It's kind of like an investment. Well, it's a project or whatever. And he stopped me cold. And he's like, you need to stop doing that. This is your business and you are the CEO. If you don't believe it, no one else will. I was shocked. It was the best sentence I've ever heard. And I think that's something that we have to tell ourselves. Like, this is your business. You are the CEO and you are, you know, responsible for making this profitable and successful. And if you don't take it serious, no one else will, you know?
Yeah, no, I love that. I'm thinking in my own head how I do that.
Yeah, and I did a
how I
did a post and asked people to introduce themselves as the CEO of their company, and I had so many likes, but only a few people participated, and the people that participated were like, "Oh my gosh, this feels so weird. Why? You know, we put in the work, we might as well get the title. Like, we need to believe it."
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. I think that sometimes, especially as resellers, we diminish the work that we do because we feel, or we encourage sometimes, which is not a bad thing, but that how we say that, you know, this is in theory simple work, mm-hmm. right? There's no barrier to entry mm-hmm. on it. You know, all you have to do is have things and have the mm-hmm. internet. And so I think that we downplay the work that we do. But the truth is that anybody who's been doing this for more than a minute knows that there's a lot of work that goes into
100%.
It. It's not as simple as like take a picture and list it. I mean, there's knowledge that goes into it. There's labor that goes into it. There's a lot of money that goes into it.
It is.
And it does become something kind of amazing.
It does. And like, we would have no problem recognizing a stockbroker when that's what they do. Mm-hmm. They do exactly what we do. They find assets, value, mm-hmm. they put in their money, and then they, you know, double their money. They just keep doing that over and over again. And I think that it's just time to kind of realize that this is a serious job. This is a serious income. This is, and yes, anyone can do it if you have Wi-Fi or whatever, but not everyone can be successful at it because you need the tools, you
right.
need the information, you need to learn, you need to grow. And so, like any business, it's like, you know, if someone ends up, I don't know, getting gifted $100,000 and you put it into the stock market, if you don't know anything about the stock market, you're not going to make money. You're probably going to lose it.
Right.
So I think it is mm-hmm. this thing of like, if we start taking it seriously, if we believe that this is a business and we are the CEO of our company and this is real, I think it kind of, it changes your perspective on your own business, you know?
Yeah.
So that's one of the advice. The second advice, or the second thing I want you to leave you guys with, is comps do not equal market value. Value is determined by the condition and the brand and market value. I want you to remember the story of how I'm the person messing up your comps the next time you're trying to price on comps. That's something that, you know, I really want to put out there. And then the last thing that I want to leave you guys with is this little statement that I have on my Instagram, that is, know your worth and pay yourself accordingly. And I think that goes back to us taking ourselves seriously as businesswomen, as, you know, the entrepreneurs that we are. The reason that I do higher price points is because I have to keep this situation going. I have to pay people and stuff. But I always tell everyone, like, there's something to be said about velocity for sure. If you're literally just, things are flying off the shelf, even at a lower profit, then keep that going. You know, that's your money just mm-hmm. keeps multiplying it by itself. But there is something to be said about, you know, investing in these higher price points, like these higher flips. And if you think about it, like, if you start sprinkling in higher price points, just it doesn't have to go up to Chanel, right? It's just wherever you are, you just start sprinkling in higher price points. It's like getting a raise for the same amount of work. And that's the power we have as business owners, as our, you know, our own bosses, is if you went to your corporate job and you told your boss, "Hey, you know what? I want to get a raise for the exact work I'm doing, same hours." He's going to think you're crazy, right? But we can do that to mm-hmm. ourselves. If you kind of start playing with these higher price points and bringing up your average profit per unit, you're technically giving yourself hourly raises anytime your ASP or your average profit goes up. So that's something that, you know
right.
your worth. And I know it's scary. And I know that sometimes, you know, we do think of it as like, oh gosh, you know, I don't want to put all this money tied up on items, or maybe there's just not that money to go in the first place. But we're not paying up, we're not buying, you know, used clothes or whatever. You have to think of it as investing. Is your money worth more in this pair of boots? In my case, it was. So that's kind of how I look at this, like, higher price point designer situation is, you know, if I keep $100 in the bank for 6 months, in 6 months, they're going to be $100. But if I take these 100 and put them in these Saint Laurent boots, they might be 400 in 2 months. So that's kind of how I think of that. So I really want you guys to just start thinking of your whole reselling process or your business as investing. And it'll take a completely different vibe and a completely different feel for you.
Yeah. No, that's great. I think all of that is really great advice. I think, yeah, my takeaway, I'm going to be thinking about that guy at the Tony Robbins conference now for the rest of my life.
I've been thinking about him for 2 years.
No, I love that. There's little things. I totally feel that. There's little things that have been said to me along the way in my life that I'm like, ooh, I will forever take that with me. Like, and I will remind people, or I will tell people whether they want to hear
that's
it or not.
Me. That's me telling you guys right now. So if we don't believe it, no one else.
Well, thank you, Issa. Yes, it's so true. If you don't believe it, nobody else is going to take you seriously. I feel that now. Yeah. I feel that. Well, thank you, Issa. This has been such a great conversation. I feel like, I mean, there's probably like seven more layers to unfold, but I'm glad I got, I think I peeled back
thank
one.
Thank you. Which is, thank you for having me. You know, I love talking about this stuff. I told you, you have to like, you know, stop me or I'll go for days, but I'm really happy if anything that we talked about in this podcast, even if one person goes like, oh, you know what, that's totally changed my mind. You know, that's what we're here for.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. To be able to share what we've learned these past few years, and hopefully they'll, you know, we'll be able to continue to share. So thank you so much for giving me your time, and I will talk with you soon.
Thank
my friend.
You. Bye, ladies.
Thank you. Bye. Hey there, thanks for tuning into the Flip the Script podcast. I wanted to take a quick moment to express my gratitude for your continued support. As a listener, you play a crucial role in the success of this podcast, and there are so many ways you can help out, and I'd love to share a few with you. For starters, you can support the podcast with a monthly donation as low as 99 cents at flipthescriptpodcast.com. Every little bit counts. And if you want to show your love even more, don't forget to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcasting platform. I read every review and really appreciate those who've left reviews already. And last but not least, be sure to check out the affiliate links in the show notes. There is a small kickback that is received from any purchases that you might make. And of course, follow flipthescript.pod on Instagram. It's also a great way to stay up to date on the latest episodes and behind the scenes content. Thank you again for being a part of the Flip the Script community. I couldn't do it without you. Thank you again to Issa for being on this week's episode of the podcast. I so enjoyed getting to learn more about your business and how you operate it so well and efficiently remotely. It's truly incredible. You can find Issa on Instagram under the username The Global Collective Co. And all of this information will be in the show notes for you. I can't believe it, guys. We are here in November. Christmas is upon us. Okay, maybe not just yet. There still is Thanksgiving. But depending on what your holiday season looks like, for a lot of people, Christmas has begun. So if you are not stocking items in your store, and no pun intended there, to sell for Q4, let's get this going. People are definitely in the shopping mood. And in order to do that, you know what I'm going to say. Keep on listing and keep on selling.